Welcome to the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jackie Forsyth, and also co-founder of the network. The purpose of the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network is to grow, strengthen, and promote research on women in sport and exercise, with the ultimate goal of optimising women's athletic success and their participation. With these podcasts, we wish to bring you information from leading academics who are researching about women in sport and exercise and provide you with advice and support for the exercising female. Please remember our disclaimer that the opinions, content and recommendations contained within our podcast are for general information only and should not be substituted for medical advice, treatment or diagnosis. Glenn Davison is a reader at the University of Kent. Glenn's research specialism is on exercise, immunology and nutrition, which includes strategies to maintain optimal health and performance in athletes. This podcast has been recorded during the COVID-19 outbreak, so I asked Glenn questions about why women seem to be at a reduced risk compared to men for coronavirus and whether as a female you can reduce your risk further. I ask him about what exercise you should be doing to improve your immune response, both when you do not have the disease and when you are experiencing COVID symptoms. Glenn also gives some tips on what nutrition and supplements could be used to improve an individual's immune response, as well as his thoughts on differences that might occur in response to respiratory infections in female athletes. So welcome, Glenn, and many thanks for doing this podcast, which is, I think, extremely needed at the moment with the current COVID-19 pandemic. I know that in your previous podcast with Judith Olgrove, we talked about immune response to exercise and specifically to women and the research around that. So I think that's a really good starting point, actually, for people to go back and have a look at your podcast, because you talked about dietary supplements, caffeine intake, that kind of thing. The evidence at the moment for COVID-19 seems to suggest that females are at less of a risk from this disease. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the statistics and the numbers that come out about the differences between males and females. I think probably one important thing that we need to be mindful of at this stage is, I don't know if it's different in terms of the actual risk of getting the illness in the first place. What the difference seems to be, certainly from the numbers that we're seeing reported, is that the really most severe and adverse outcomes, and it's the statistics that we get on death rate, is a lot higher in males, so therefore is a lot lower in females. So we seem to be seeing a difference in the outcome, or in the worst outcomes, and we seem to be seeing a lower risk of those worst outcomes, which are deaths, in females compared to males. We don't really know or understand the reasons for that. However, there's a few theories that have been discussed. One of the theories is that on average, or in the general population, we do know that females tend to have a stronger immune response, certainly the immune response to viral infection. And so one possibility is that females' immune response, although it might not necessarily mean that males and females have a different incidence of getting COVID-19 in the first place, but when they've got it, perhaps if the females are having a stronger immune response, they could be dealing with it and able to get rid of it more quickly, or to get rid of it and suffer less severely with it. So that is one possible explanation, but as I said, we don't fully understand all of the reasons. So some of this is just theories and speculations that have been made at the moment. One of the other things could be something as simple as, we know that other risk factors and other health conditions are also really important, and we know that certain risk groups, so for example, people who have certain chronic diseases, things like cardiovascular disease, things like diabetes and stuff like that, they are at a greater risk of having a worse outcome if they do become infected. And we know that the prevalence of some of these diseases are lower in females. So that could be an indirect mechanism that explains that. And finally, another potential mechanism is the general hormonal profile in females can mean that sometimes females have a better anti-inflammatory response in some respects. And we know that one of the risks and one of the potential causes of a really bad outcome with COVID-19 is this almost sort of delayed or sort of secondary effect, what they are referring to as the cytokine storm, which is almost where the immune system really overreacts and causes lots of collateral damage that can result in negative outcomes. And there's a possibility that in females, this is less likely to occur. But the one thing that I will say is that all of these, I guess, are kind of speculations on different theories that have been discussed as a potential reason to explain the differences purely in death rates between males and females. It's probable that it's some combination of all of these different things at different levels.
So going back to the hormone related issue though, is then the case that I know it's a minor thing compared to a whole array of other factors that could mean that women are at a reduced risk of COVID. But if there is a hormonal related issue, could it be then women are better off if they're not using, say, oral contraception for contraceptive purposes, that they could come off that and have a normal eumenorrheic menstrual cycle, therefore have higher levels of estrogen, which could boost their immune function or immune response, and that postmenopausal women could carry on using HRT to increase estrogen so that they have a better immune response? Is there something in that at all, do you think?
Possibly. I mean, I guess the only clues that we can really get, or the clues that we can look at that might give us a little bit of insight, but again, we're having to speculate somewhat, and we're having to look at other respiratory illnesses in general. But one of the things that we do know in females who are sort of experiencing normal menstrual cycles and are having natural cycles, so they're not using oral contraceptives or any kind of hormonal therapy or anything like that. What we do actually know is that the general risk and the general incidence of normal respiratory infections is actually higher when progesterone is higher. So, for example, in the luteal phase or sort of shortly after you've got that higher progesterone levels, that tends to be associated with a greater risk of respiratory illness and respiratory infections in general. So it's possible that oral contraceptive use, which is generally going to be providing high exogenous doses of progesterone, if it is really progesterone that's causing that increased risk or is contributing to the mechanisms of that increased risk, then it could be that things that increase it would increase the risk of respiratory illness or respiratory infection in general. I don't know whether it would make any difference to the risk of getting COVID-19, because I think it's such an infective, such a contagious virus that anybody who's exposed to it is probably going to get it. But if there are things which influence how the immune system responds, then perhaps the outcome could be different, or it could be influenced by how well the immune system's functioning, how well you're able to clear it, how well you're able to recover from it, and stuff like that.
Is that the same for exercise then? So if COVID is so infectious, so dramatic, is there anything you can do in terms of exercise to improve your immune response?
Again, it's difficult to say for certain because we don't know that much about this particular virus, but looking at the way it's spreading around the globe and how infectious it seems to be, my kind of intuition would say that if you're exposed to it, you're going to get infected. So in terms of the typical relationships that we see between the amount of physical activity that somebody does and their risk of getting ill, and certain amounts might lower that risk of getting general respiratory infections, and other amounts might increase that risk. I think that for COVID-19, it probably wouldn't influence it whatsoever. If you're exposed, you're probably going to get infected. But what we do know, of course, is that regular amounts of moderate exercise are generally beneficial for the immune system. So my intuition would say, if you're generally fit and healthy, and if you continue to take part in regular exercise, then there's a possibility that you will suffer less, or you might clear it more quickly, or you might have a better outcome afterwards in groups of, you know, fit individuals who are regularly taking part in moderate exercise, as opposed to, for example, individuals who are sedentary. But yeah, the key, I guess the most important risk factor that we know, and that's why we have this lockdown situation that we're experiencing at the moment, is exposure. So for individuals who are exercising, then minimizing their exposure and following the, you know, the social distancing guidelines and all of that sort of stuff is the biggest thing that people can do to reduce their risk of becoming infected in the first place.
So it's kind of then okay to do vigorous exercise, really intense exercise or prolonged exercise, which usually is associated with at least an initial drop in immune response and then a boost afterwards. But initially, there might be this window where you might be more infected, because if you're socially isolating, you're not going to come in close proximity with anybody who's got it. So you're okay then to carry on doing intense exercise. Would that be right?
Yeah, I would say any type of exercise is probably okay if you are able to minimize your exposure. And if we're specifically talking about COVID-19 here, so if everybody is isolating, if everybody is following the social distancing guidelines and the regulations and all of that sort of stuff, then doing exercise in general is chronically going to be beneficial for health in general and lots of other risk factors, not just physical, but also psychological well-being and stuff like that. So any type of exercise is going to be beneficial. And because we've kind of got putting a silver lining on it, because we've got the luxury of isolating and, you know, working from home and social distancing and all of that sort of stuff, then the usual risks that we caution athletes for during what we refer to as this risk period is less likely. So as long as people are able to follow that, then I would say any type of exercise is going to be beneficial because of the myriad of other beneficial effects of exercise that we have. And they don't need to be as worried as long as they are very strict and follow all of the social distancing and minimizing the exposure. I suppose another thing to throw into the mix, of course, is people who are isolating or who are working from home, or their life has really been changed and they've had a massive upheaval as a result of this in recent times, that there might be the temptation to overdo it. And all of a sudden, they might have been doing on average half an hour of exercise every couple of days. They suddenly decide they're going to increase that to doing 2 hours every single day. And that wouldn't be a good idea for a number of other reasons. It's going to increase their risk of going down that overtraining path, going down that burnout path, increased risk of injury, and potentially doing themselves some kind of harm or injury that might mean they actually have to stop exercising because they're injured. So another caution that I would throw in there is don't overdo it, especially if you're trying new types of exercise or if you're doing something that you've never done before. Don't overdo it and try to be sensible. And if you are going to increase the amount that you're doing or try something new, increase gradually.
And what about, Glenn, if you've got symptoms of COVID or you think potentially you might have it, should you carry on exercising, or is there a rule about, what is it, above the neck rule, that you should be in bed?
And I mean, the above the neck rule refers to respiratory infection or respiratory illness symptoms in general. I know there's big differences in how bad people suffer. So some people have very bad symptoms and some people have not so bad symptoms. So if you feel really, really bad, then you shouldn't really exercise. You need to rest and recover. And if people have symptoms, we couldn't know for certain if they have COVID-19 or if they have some other upper respiratory infection. So it's difficult to give, you know, a specific opinion on if you have COVID compared to any other type of respiratory infection. I think probably the judgment that an individual would need to make for themselves if they have symptoms is purely based on the symptoms that they have, where they are and how bad they are. So the above the neck rule is quite a good rule. And what that basically means is if the symptoms are mild or moderate, and if they are isolated to above the neck only. So, you know, if it's just a little bit of a sore throat, if it's a little bit of a runny nose and sneezing, slight sort of headache and things like that, if they're still mild, but otherwise you feel generally well, you know, if there's no kind of general sort of systemic symptoms, if there's no sort of elevations in resting heart rate, if you feel generally well, then it's usually considered safe to continue with moderate exercise, really light stuff. So, you know, sort of the sort of more low intensity stuff is generally considered safe. If people do that, though, they should keep an eye on their symptoms. And if they start to get worse, then they need to, you know, maybe rethink and sort of ease off a little bit. If they start to improve, then they might be able to increase what they're doing a little bit, but they really should wait until there's been substantial improvement and the symptoms have gone. If they've got more severe symptoms, or if they are below the neck, so we're talking about symptoms that are now maybe on the chest, or if they're feeling really unwell, if they're experiencing aches and sort of general muscle soreness that is unrelated to exercise. So, for example, if it's just general illness and general kind of aches that you don't necessarily know what the cause of them is, or you can't link it to any type of activity that you've done, then the general recommendation would be that they really need to stop and they need to rest and they need to wait until those symptoms have completely subsided before they return to exercise. And when they return to exercise, they shouldn't jump straight back in where they were before. They should return gradually. And because you need to make sure that it's fully gone and that you've fully cleared it. Otherwise, if you go straight into heavy exercise again and you're still actually harboring a bit of an infection that you haven't really got rid of, there's sometimes a chance that it can basically come back and sometimes be worse, or it can cause some real negative effects and you know, increase other risks of more severe infections elsewhere in the body that actually could be very, very dangerous. So I guess if there's any doubt in the athlete's mind, or if there's any doubt in the person's mind, then they really should ease off and wait until those symptoms have gone completely and come back gradually.
And what about nutrition? Because I know you do research on nutrition and supplements. What about that idea, feed a cold, starve a flu? Is that potentially the same for COVID-19?
Yeah, it's an interesting thought that there's, I'm aware of some research that's been done a couple of years ago, and it's came from the kind of the idea of, if it's a viral type infection, then you might want to feed it. If it's a non-viral type infection, and if it's the kind of illness, or if it's something where you might have a fever or something like that, then there's been some suggestions that actually maybe starving it is better. But specifically looking at viral type infections, and most of the upper respiratory infections, or most of the respiratory infections that we do experience, are viral infections, or that they are caused by a virus. There is some evidence suggesting that if you are fed as opposed to fasted, that you have a better immune response against viral type infections. So that's kind of the feed a cold side of that. There could be something in it, yes, although the evidence is a little bit mixed, and quite a lot of the evidence is from animal studies as well. So we do have to be a little bit careful about translating that to humans. But I think there's reasonable evidence to suggest that providing nutrition, providing nutrients, so energy, okay, the body needs energy to recover, the immune system needs energy to function at its best. So for viral type infections, I would say having a good, healthy and balanced diet is probably going to be beneficial. I certainly can't think of any reasons why it would be a bad thing. So for this type of infection, I would say feed it would probably be the most pragmatic advice. But healthy, balanced diet, nutritious, all of that sort of stuff, good balance of nutrients, good variety and all of that sort of stuff would probably be the best advice.
Sounds good to me. No extreme dieting.
Yeah.
Great. But what about supplements then? Because you look at the shelves and like toilet paper, all the supplements just completely went. And I just happened to see something on the news yesterday, which was some woman in America saying that she had vitamin D, she got the sunshine, so she's completely immune, which is, you know, obviously not right. But is there anything in that in terms of vitamin D supplements or any other supplement or probiotics or anything that particularly we should be trying to take more in to improve our immune response?
Well, any type of nutrient that you would normally get and that you need for general health, obviously we need it for a reason, but most of the time we get it from our diet. Vitamin D is slightly different because we get most of our vitamin D from sun exposure or exposure of the skin to the sun. But we know that deficiencies of certain nutrients, almost any nutrient, if you are severely deficient in it, is going to have a negative effect on your immune system. And that's not going to be good in terms of your risk of getting ill and your ability to deal with an infection when you do get it. So definitely a deficiency of a nutrient is going to be bad. And if an individual is deficient, if they correct that deficiency, then that's going to have a beneficial effect. The best way to correct a deficiency is to improve your diet. So if you are deficient because your diet is bad, if you sort your diet out and overcome that deficiency and get the intake to the level that it should be, then that is going to have a beneficial effect. But that is not really the same as having a beneficial effect from taking extra. All that is doing is returning you to your normal healthy status. So by being deficient, you're actually reducing your immune system and you're reducing how your immune system is functioning. So if we improve somebody's diet, or if they do take a supplement, and if that brings them back to being non-deficient, really what that's doing is returning them to normal. So interpreting that as a boost, if you like, is probably not the most accurate way to interpret it. And the mistake that people sometimes make when they have information like that is they then extrapolate it and say, okay, well, then if I take extra above my natural requirement, then that's going to provide further benefit. And for most nutrients, that's not the case. So I guess to summarize that in a short way, a deficiency is bad. If you correct a deficiency, there's going to be improvement. But if you take extra on top of that, then it's not normally going to provide any further benefit. And in fact, some nutrients, you can take too much. You can essentially overdose on certain nutrients. And vitamin D is one of the things that falls into that category, actually. It's a fat-soluble vitamin, and it can accumulate in the body. So if you're taking high supplemental dosages of that, then that can actually have some negative effects. So avoiding deficiency is probably the best advice. Taking extra on top of what you already have, if your diet is really good, most of the time doesn't provide any further benefit. There are a couple of exceptions to that, of course, and some of the things that you wouldn't normally get in a diet, or some of the things that you don't need for general health and well-being, assuming that you're generally healthy, some of those things you can get further benefit if you add them on top of a normal, healthy and balanced diet. You mentioned probiotics, and that's one of the supplements where there is pretty strong evidence for beneficial effects in terms of influencing the immune system and reducing the risk of various types of illnesses. The thing with probiotics, of course, is there's so much variation in terms of the quality and the concentration, and so many different strains of bacteria that you could find in these probiotics, and they basically don't all do the same thing. So some types of probiotics might be beneficial for enhancing immune function, but they might not do anything for gut symptoms. Other strains of probiotics might be really good for gut health and gut symptoms, but they actually don't do anything in terms of upper respiratory infections. So there is some evidence out there, some reasonable evidence for good quality probiotics supplements. There was one paper a few years ago, actually, which did suggest that effect was less pronounced in females compared to males. So it might be that the females were less able to see a benefit from something like probiotics, but that was only one study. Most other supplements and things that you can take from a normal, or that you can obtain from a normal diet, limited evidence that they're actually beneficial under normal circumstances.
Where can we get probiotics from in our diet? That improve risk of upper respiratory infections.
So probiotics are the one of the examples where you wouldn't really get a very high amount from a normal diet. You will find it in things like sort of fermented milk and fermented dairy products. So you will naturally find it in things like that, but not quite to the same level that you would find in a supplement or something that's been specifically produced, or where the strains of bacteria have been kind of purified and harvested and included. So probiotics is one of the examples where actually taking a supplement, which is going to be on top of what you would have in a normal diet, has got some reasonably good evidence that could be beneficial. What I would say, if you're going to use probiotics, get a good quality one. So use a one from a reputable supplier, a reputable manufacturer, or do a little bit of research and see if there's been any publications specifically using the strain or specifically using the product that you're interested in. And if there's been any publications showing a beneficial effect, then you can be a little bit more confident that that particular product would be beneficial. If it's just a kind of bargain basement, the cheapest you can find, then I'd be a little bit kind of less confident that that would actually have any beneficial effects.
And has this coronavirus disease sparked any interest for you in terms of research? Is there anything that's caught your eye that you found interesting or you want to explore further?
I mean, one of the interesting things is we spoke at the beginning about, in the general population, the worst outcomes and the reported death rates seem to be a lot lower in females compared to males. And there's potential reasons for that, but that is in the general population. What it would be interesting to know a little bit more about, if this data does become available later, or if somebody was to do research on this in the future, is what about in athletic populations? Do we still sort of see that same difference between males and females in physically active population or in an elite athlete population? I mean, that population is probably a population that's less at risk, so you're not going to be seeing the high numbers of really severe outcomes like death in, I guess, healthy, fit, active population. But if we are seeing infection in that sort of sporting or athletic population, it would be interesting to see the other outcomes, like the duration of illness, how quickly they clear it, how severe they suffer with it, other responses that are maybe not at the top of the agenda from a sort of, you know, a general public health perspective, and they're not the statistics that are being reported by governments. But it would be interesting to see whether in a sporting population, do we still see differences between males and females in other outcomes from people who are infected? That might tell us some useful information about contributing risk factors as well. One of the reasons why that's interesting to me is because, although in the general population for respiratory infections in general, females seem to be at a lower risk, but in athletic populations and in sporting individuals, it's sometimes actually much more similar between males and females. And it has actually flipped over in one study, whereby when they were looking at reports of upper respiratory symptoms around major competitions, a study from a couple of years ago actually reported that that was higher in females. We don't fully understand the reasons behind that. I have speculated in the past that it could be to do with behavioural factors. For example, there's a possibility that because it's a major competition like the Olympics, for example, and you've got this kind of 4-year run in, and then you've got this 2-week period where your whole career might depend on it, there's a possibility that females might decide to change their oral contraceptive use in order to try and time, you know, when they might have a period or something like that in relation to when they are going to be competing. And as we talked about at the beginning, we know that during phases of the menstrual cycle or during periods when progesterone is high, that's actually the period that is the most risky period for females in terms of respiratory illness. So I guess one of my speculations is when we see an increased respiratory illness risk in females around major competitions, could it be related to something behavioural, like have they started to change the timing of their oral contraceptive use or something like that, if they were using it? But I guess the fact that we've seen differences to the profile that you see when you compare males and females in the general population, when you look at some groups of athletes, it would be interesting to know, if you look at different subgroups within the population, do you still see the same patterns across all of those groups?
Well, thanks very much, Glenn. I mean, all of that's been really interesting. And there's so much to this, isn't there? I mean, there's so many facets, so many dimensions, and it's really hard to answer some of the questions, especially with this virus being so novel, so new, and we just don't know what's going on. I'm sure, though, that's been really helpful for most people. So thanks again for joining me on this podcast.
No problem. It was a pleasure.